Hello and welcome to Connected, the Sunday Business Post technology podcast brought to you in association with Dell EMC. I'm Emmett Ryan, and today it's our first podcast in over a month. Of course, as you all know from when you were listening last time, I went off my travels, Turkey. That was great, by the way. And we were doing lots of other bits in between, but we finally, thankfully, are back after a lengthy break. All the other podcasts in the post seem to be going along quite strongly after we set the standard many, many moons ago. So welcome to our legal podcast with Francesca hosting that. But Connected, of course, our flagship show, the tech podcast, we are back and we have a great guest today. He's come up all the way from Limerick and he is the director of Lero, Professor Brian Fitzgerald. Brian, welcome along to Connected.
Thank you, Emmett. Good to be here.
And Brian, obviously, Lero has been around quite a while, about a dozen years, roughly speaking, based down in Limerick. I suppose before we get into what we're going to talk about today, which is sort of about the future software catastrophes that we're looking at, and, you know, people, even before we even say that, people go, oh, come on, it's like, because security fatigue is such a thing, but it is relevant, like, because the problems keep getting there and keep getting harder. Tell people just a bit about Lero for those who aren't as familiar with the organization. Like, what do you all do down there?
Sure. So Lero is an interesting example of what we can do in a small country. So Ireland has 7 universities. They can't all be world-class universities, but if you combine the expertise in different areas across the universities, you get a very compelling proposition that nowhere else in the world is doing this. So we're a software research center, and we're a one-stop shop. So every software-related problem, we know where to get the best solution in our different partners. So if a company has a problem, they come to us. We, in the past, that would have been a kind of fight over who you stay with us, we'll solve it in each university. Now we direct them to the university where the expertise is. So it works really well as a collaborative venture among the universities. And it's repeated, we're the software one, but it's also repeated in data analytics, in networking, in pharmaceuticals, in materials. So we really have a good example here that we're the envy of much of the world, actually. We've managed to find that level of collaboration and punch way above our weight. So if you look at the international figures, actually, for how Ireland has come from, you know, in the low, almost 100th in the world, outside the top 100 in terms of performance in scientific research, we're now first in a number of areas and in the top 10 in several areas. And that's all down to 15 years or so of collaborative research across the universities working together. So it's very exciting. So we're the software one of those.
And I suppose, well, the downside in terms of the ignorance is bliss perspective when you're in that position is you all see all the terrible things that are about to happen before they happen, and you're very much on top of it, which is great, obviously, in terms of preparing, but also somewhat terrifying, I'm sure, as well, because, like, when most of our listeners and the readers of the paper, you know, think about, you know, threats around, you know, their security online or their safety online, they're immediately thinking of the type of nefarious actors. The WannaCry, obviously, issue back in May was massive. I remember our coverage was ridiculously extensive with cause. But one of the things you're noticing is it's not even the nefarious type of stuff. A lot of it is to do with, it's the future proofing, essentially. It's the speed of getting stuff out, like, because, you know, I was looking at some notes beforehand and, like, we're facing a crisis here, and you're calling it sort of a software crisis 2.0. So just give us the broad details of what we're actually staring down.
Sure. Okay. So I should tell you what software crisis 1.0 was, because that's very instructive, I think. So the software field is only about 50 years old. It's one of the earliest, one of the newest engineering fields. When it began in the late 1950s, within 10 years, it came from the military, but then people started to use computing for commercial purposes. They found within 10 years that they called it a crisis, because they couldn't get people to write good software, to write programs properly. There were no training programs. So what happened, in actual fact, in organizations at the time, a new data processing, electronic data processing departments were set up. They invited people to come from around the organization. And what typically happened is, someone described it as people became programmers through an unlikely accident. So the ne'er-do-wells and misfits in the organizations pretty much joined this new electronic data processing department. So they couldn't write programs properly, and there were no training programs. So that was the first software crisis, about 1967. A conference in Germany described that everyone reported the same problems globally, that no one could write software properly.
It does sort of sound like the movie The Right Stuff, only if everything went wrong, essentially.
Yes, well, yes. But they everything did go wrong. And it took us 30 years to figure that out, to come up with ways of doing that, of solving that problem. And what happened is all companies are becoming software companies in our experience. If you get out of bed today, look at your mobile phone, you've already run a million lines of software. So it's really affecting our lives. What we feel is that So the telecoms, banking was probably one of the first sectors to become softer driven. Telecoms as well, back in the early days. Now, so in the 1960s, they found they needed about 10 times as much software as they could produce. Now, we had a study recently, Mercedes released in the automotive sector, that they figure they need 300 times as much software as being produced. That's the prediction from what they, the amount of code they can produce. Can we produce that much software reliably? We don't believe so. So that's the essence of the software crisis 2.0, that we now need to produce about 300 times as much software for every company. And it's in the context of which, for example, you've got Internet of Things or trillions of sensors delivering data. It's software that makes sense of those data. We have these new applications, also new technology, for example, cognitive computing. You know, the IBM Watson computer was in the news recently for beating a grandmaster in chess and for solving Jeopardy problems. You have to be able to write software to take advantage of that architecture. Quantum computing is something no one knows how to do properly. So what we have is this new software crisis where we need 300 times as much software as we can produce, and we need to produce that for Mercedes cars, for example, so it doesn't break, they don't break down and kill people. So that's a huge challenge. And on top of that, we would say it's different now because we've got what we call the digital natives. These are the millennials who don't care about they don't need. In the past, you had to persuade people to use computer software. You had extensive training programs. People were nervous about it. Now these people have an insatiable appetite for new applications. We can't produce them quickly enough, and that's a real problem, I think. So the software crisis 2.0 is increased demand that we can't keep up with, and much more complex problems we're trying to solve. And that's what we're about in Lero, is trying to understand how to produce that software properly so we don't get crises like WannaCry and so on.
And I just want to go back on a few of the details you brought up there, because I always, when I'm trying to explain to people who are like, just for the lack of understanding what people have as to the computing power they carry around in their pocket, I always point out to them that, like, you know, the smartphone in your pocket has got substantially several factors the amount of computing power that it took to send the Apollo 11 rocket to the moon.
A huge amount.
And so when you say that to someone, that puts it sort of in the human context, and they go, oh, right. And so, so there's an awful lot of work required for that, even with the evolution of technology. You know, it's still a lot of work required to make sure that all works. The thing is, with that younger generation, talking about the millennials, we like to use the term and all that, they aren't just sort of that they expect it to all be there, but they're the ones who are going to be the first to criticize if it goes wrong as well, because they're used to it. So that puts like the extra pressure on it, that there's this demand to get it all out in time, but also there's this demand to make sure it doesn't have all the faults you're saying are going to be inevitable.
And that's a really interesting one. An example I like to give is Bebo. So Bebo was blog early, blog often. It was an early social media site that many people might remember. It was the most popular website in Ireland in 2007-08. No one has heard of it even now. It disappeared overnight because these digital natives found Facebook to be together. So there was no incentive. They just moved with their feet, and just that platform disappeared. So you can have that kind of thing. These are impatient. If there's a better application, better software somewhere else, they will go with it. So it's very disruptive. Like the car companies like Mercedes, which have been around for hundreds of years, they're probably more worried that a brand like Google or Apple brings out a car and everyone says, I'd prefer to drive an Apple car than a Porsche or whatever. You know, that kind of brand identity is very real, that that customers will, you know, the old-fashioned rules are no longer apply, I guess.
Now, when you're talking about the volume side, because obviously those companies have to adapt to that, like, just getting back to that number, that the amount of stuff required from is 300 times what it was 20 years ago, that presents an obvious problem in terms of how we solve it. And before we get to IoT and other areas of that, which are obviously part of the issue, like, fundamentally, like, because, like, that's such a huge increase in amount, like, how do you even go about working out how you address that problem, like?
Sure. And so we probably don't produce enough people on the planet to solve it. So part of it will be, I have a very positive view of virtual reality, augmented reality, artificial intelligence, that, like, we're working, we have people working on writing parallel programs. That's another part of it, where you've got multiple processors and computers, and you want them to, normally computers run sequentially on the processor, whereas if you can divide the work up among many processors, then you can do it in parallel more quickly. But it's very difficult to write those kinds of programs. We have people working on artificial machine learning, basically writing those programs automatically and outperforming humans. So we have a person who won a competition recently for writing his evolutionary algorithm, worked out how to write a program more quickly and better than the human expert, and in a non-intuitive way. There's an unusual element in the program that a human expert had never come up with, but it was really effective at leveraging multiple cores. So that's part of the problem, is the computer itself. Finally, you know, for years people expected virtual, or that the programs would replace humans. We're finally starting to see that. It's a very positive view I have of the computer helping us by being able to solve those kinds of problems. But it's only part of the problem. You also need to produce people enough skill to and understand how to do that. So it's not going to be an easy. The first one wasn't easy. It took us 30 years to solve the first software crisis. There's no evidence that we will automatically solve this more quickly. But it is very serious for us.
And obviously, the rise of Internet of Things is something you've brought up as well before. Now, a lot of our listeners are familiar with the sort of typical areas you'd expect to see the obvious pressure, namely sort of data centers, obviously, because the amount of data being created, and likewise, any sort of telecoms provider, because again, the data has to be transmitted some way. And they're the two who are, like, I suppose, most vocal in saying, we need to prepare for this, we need to do a lot more than most other sectors are. And like, in fairness, most sectors are talking about it quite a lot within tech. So, but those two I would stand out. But I suppose, in terms of sort of this software challenge, like, where does the IoT come into it?
Well, so, like, IoT is where a lot of things meet, a lot of technologies meet there. Obviously, it's a huge software element, but there's also a lot of hardware, the physical sensors, that fusion of software and hardware in providing value. It's not going to be solved by software people alone. But more and more, what we find is, if you look at the history of technology, many companies, you know, like companies that were semiconductor companies in the past, they're on the record, they're saying, well, we're now software companies. The trouble is, our engineers don't realize that yet. So, like, if you talk to, we had a meeting with Huawei recently, 85% of their engineers are software engineers. BMW, if you look at the growth in how mechanical engineers and electronic engineers, they're overtaken now by software engineers. That's the game in town for many people. That's the one that will have to be solved in conjunction. So you'll need the software engineers working with the hardware engineers. No one has the whole picture. So it's about collaboration to try to solve those problems. But the challenge is huge. The opportunity is enormous. So some of the things we now do because of that kind of having access to data and combining it in unusual ways is really exciting. It's the most exciting time to have ever lived, I would say. Yeah.
The problem with exciting times is they are often because of, if things go wrong, things could get exciting in a different way. Yes. So in terms of the sort of the practical implications, if we don't get a grip on this reasonably, like, what are we looking at as sort of the knock-on impacts, be it for business, be it for end users?
Well, I think it's extinction for many businesses if you don't get right. Like, what worries me, for example, is there's no shoebox anymore, is how I describe it. So in the old days, you put your money in the bank, and it was probably in something like a shoebox. You knew you could go and look at it every so often. You had your bank book, and you kept that under your bed or something, but you didn't have the money under the bed, but it was in the bank's shoebox, not your shoebox, but you could see it. Now we assume that that our money is in the bank, but if the bank had no record of it, if that record disappears, or someone, like, there is no way of, we're very vulnerable to a system that we have no longer any physical. You know, we trust, we rely on a system for which there is no longer any shoebox. We don't basically have a shoebox. So you're trusting a system that everyone takes for granted that it won't break. And that's a serious concern, I think. You know.
It's really starting to sound like the monorail episode of The Simpsons in many respects. And that's probably not the best analogy in terms of people not being terrified.
The Simpsons got there first.
Absolutely, like, seldom break. But I suppose one thing, because we bring back to that younger generation, is one of the sort of the upsides is because we have that sort of balance in that the most demanding group for new software is also the most demanding in terms of the quality and maintenance. Is that a reason to be hopeful that the industry is going to adapt itself?
I think it is. I think, yeah, so you're like, the better mousetrap isn't necessarily, you know, it's not enough. People have to perceive it as that, so they have to trust it. It has to be well designed. There's so much, like, if things aren't good, the better option will be found by people, and it's global. So your competitor is no longer, it's not who's in the same city as you, same country as you. Your competitor is global now, so people can access, they can source the replacement from anywhere in the world just online. You know, that's a frightening thing for many companies. So customer loyalty, retaining customers, you know, it costs 30 times as much to get a new customer as retain an existing one. Retention is difficult because these people are unforgiving if the quality isn't there. But that's probably a good sign. That will probably encourage companies to put effort into quality, you know.
And like it sort of springs to an awful lot of how sort of the economy sort of for companies has changed radically, because most companies, if you ask them who their competitors were 10 years ago, it's very different types of companies, not just the names, but the types of companies to who they are today. Because, you know, you look at even within sort of, you know, entertainment, within, you know, media, within any sort of, you know, production company of any kind, be it like, you know, any sort of product, really, if you're selling anything, the odds are who you're competing with because of software issues, essentially, is different now.
And that's true. And also, who, in terms of who you are. So there are very few companies now are just 10 people in one location. You know, it's like you've got, most companies are geographically distributed, so you get the expertise where you can get it. Using technology, people can program in India, send the solutions here, and you know, so you've got companies are virtually located. You don't, it doesn't matter really. You don't even know if they're next door or where they are, you know, but they deliver a service or they deliver something to you. In, and as long as that works, you don't really care whether they're next door or 2,000 miles away, or whether the whole company is globally distributed. It doesn't matter to you as long as you're getting a good quality product, I guess.
And I'd say for you and Lira, that's been an interesting journey as well, because you've been there 12 years. Yeah. You're the director about a year now. Obviously, you've been there in other various senior roles.
Yes.
I'm guessing what you were looking at as being the focus and goal of Lira has changed significantly in 12 years.
It has. It has, yeah, and that's, and we have to now propose our next round of funding will be for the period 2021 to 2026, so that's 9 years away. Trying to predict, like, it's very interesting. If you ever think of predicting forward in technology, it's very instructive to look back 10 years and the things that didn't exist 10 years ago, you know, like, so, well, Bebo would have been huge 10 years ago, but it doesn't exist anymore, you know, so there are things that were huge in the marketplace to companies that were around 10 years ago, many of them don't exist anymore, you know, so 10 years, things, you never, what you predict will move slowly, moves much more quickly, and what you predict will move quickly moves more slowly, so it's very hard to get it right, you know.
Because like, who was talking about Facebook Live 10 years ago?
Yeah, exactly.
And the likes of that. Like, I'm just thinking of, you know, the typical apps people use on the messaging side, because SMS was still a very powerful force back then.
Yes.
And so you even think of like some obvious stuff where you're kind of going, oh wow, that's changed a lot. Like,
yes.
Because obviously, the iPhone 10 moment there was only a few months back, and the number of people who didn't realize the iPhone was only 10 years old was a real penny drop moment for them.
And that's what, exactly. That's why I say when you look back 10 years ago, the iPhone came out. It's exactly 10 years ago, I think. And we assume it's been around forever, you know? And it's like how quickly it's augmented the amount of things you can do on that now. You know, we just take for granted new technology all the time. But they are exciting times, as you say, you know?
And so the last thing we want to ask you is about sort of Lira, your mission going forward. So when you're trying to project for 9 years from now, it's challenging. So obviously you can't fully future-proof for that. If you did, let's be honest, it'd be an incredibly boring world we'd live in. If you could do it, if it was easy. So how do you guys, like, you know, get ready, you know, have a guess at what's going forward, but also find ways to be able to adapt as it comes along?
Sure. So you evolve towards the future as well, obviously. Or as Bill Joy said, the best way to, you know, to predict the future is to invent it. So we have certain core competences. They won't disappear overnight. And what you have is companies are on a different trajectory and scaling to becoming software companies. So what the banking sector went through at first, then telecoms, then other sectors, semiconductor, maybe automotive, you're getting them more recently. So some of the things you learned in the previous industry you can apply again. Then there will be new areas like artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning. Those are huge areas. So we're big in that space. Autonomous vehicles is a big space for us. Software performance is another big space, so very large cloud-based systems, and security and privacy. So there are kind of core areas are there where I think the really interesting things are happening in two ways. One is applying those in new domains like medtech, sports tech, fintech, and smart cities. So trying to do it in those kinds of new areas. And the other thing is more holistic solutions. So instead of just being, we're the software guys, we're also trying to, this has happened to us over 12 years, what we found is that the software solution, most companies, you have companies who just have sensors, for example, it's not enough to sell a sensor. You could sell a sensor 10 years ago. Now it also has to have an application program interface and a graphical user interface, but also the data on that sensor is really valuable. So what companies are trying to do now is say, well, I'm selling you a product, but I also can provide some data and provide some extra business model around that data. So it's not, you know, companies aren't hardware companies anymore. So what I have found over the 12 years is that we have been pushed to be more holistic in our solutions. So it isn't enough for us to come to a company and say, well, here's the software element of it. They're also looking for the data governance, for example, the business model of it, how they might commercialize it, so that, you know, how human-computer interaction, for example, how you might design the interface. So what we find is that we're required to bring many disciplines to the party, and that's what we're doing, basically. We're growing our membership base to be more holistic, so we don't just go in there with, you know, with a technical view. We go in there with a business view and a social view. So it's, you know, we have economists, we have sociologists, we have business people, human computer interaction people, as well as software people. And that becomes very exciting then, because the company gets the whole solution. You know, they don't, it isn't as if you throw somebody off a cliff and say, well, we can take it so far. But we're trying to work all those things together. And many things, the technology has to fit in the world. So in connected health and things like that, technology is no use if people can't find a way, if the people for whom it's designed cannot use it properly. So that's a big thing for us, is trying to ensure that, like we talked about it earlier, that the digital natives are the people for whom the technology is intended. It works in the way that suits them, not the other way around.
And if people want to, before you go, Brian, if you want to learn more about Lyra and what you all are doing, what's the best way for them to find out?
Our website, I guess, is where they find out. But we're a national centre, so it's headquartered in Limerick, but it's in all the Irish universities, Dundalk Institute of Technology and Tralee Institute of Technology. So there'll be people in all those places. But we turn up at events all the time, Pint of Science, you know, the Ploughing Championships, the Young Scientists, we're everywhere. So we have our mandate is to go and make sure the public know about it. So we spend a lot of time at events, educational events and hackathons, that kind of thing. So if anything to do with Coda Dojo, hackathons like that, you'll find Lyra is probably pretty prominent there.
Well, Professor Brian Fitzgerald, Director of Lyra, thank you very much for joining us on Connected this week. Before we go, just a quick note about our next show coming up. We're going to be talking about blockchain and cryptocurrencies next week with our guest, which is kind of interesting because, of course, we're recording this episode on the day that Harry Redknapp, the football manager, decided he's now backing a cryptocurrency. So hopefully my guest next week will be able to explain why Harry's interested in cryptocurrencies, because I don't really know what he's at. Our next issue of Connected Magazine is out on the 5th of November, and we have a pretty good cover story coming up, but it's actually a little bit too early in the cycle, sadly, to tell you what it is, so you're all going to wait a couple more weeks before I can tell you that. And as ever, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Dell EMC, for the support of the Connected podcast. And until next time, and of course, thanks all for waiting the month for me to come back, but until next time, I'm just going to keep being Emmett Ryan.
When will I be able to hear it myself?